This is Kelly Krieger conducting an oral history interview with Lieutenant Colonel retired Richard Alexander. Today is 15 March 2016. I am in Lubbock, Texas on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Colonel Alexander is joining me by telephone from his home in Forson, Colorado. Colonel, to begin this interview, I'd like to get some background information from you, if I could. Could you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born September 20th, 1936.
What were your parents' names?
My dad's name was Anthony, and my mother's name was Mary.
Okay. What did your parents do for a living down there in Louisiana?
Well, my dad was the manager of a furniture store. And when we were 10, the store was robbed, and he was killed.
Oh, wow.
I had a twin brother who in 72 was same thing. He was killed in a holdup.
Wow.
New Orleans is not a nice place to live. It's a nice place sometimes to visit. So, and my mother was a housewife.
Mm-hmm.
It's ironic because my brother was 36 and I was the same age my dad was.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That must have been incredibly difficult on you, your brother, and your mother.
Well, my brother's son was 29. He was killed. He was coming out of a restaurant and somebody wanted his automobile and held him up and shot him.
Hmm. Wow, that's just a tragic history there.
So, I guess the best thing I ever did was get out.
Yeah.
Well, that I went to, of course, grammar school and high school. And after high school, I joined the Louisiana Air National Guard and we flying B-26s. I was a flight engineer gunner on the B-26.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to where I liked it, so I decided to go to night school and get my grades up a little better than what they were. And I went up to Baton Rouge to Louisiana State University. Went through ROTC, graduated, went into the Air Force in November 1961.
Yep. Why did you choose the Air Force?
It interested me. With the flying aspects, and you know, I was flying in the Air National Guard, and I just could see that when you were flying, you were by yourself up there. You were the boss.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first started off, let me go back. I wanted to join the Air National Guard, but at the time they said couldn't have brothers together. And this was due to the bit they had about World War II in the Navy, where they had five brothers on one ship.
Mm-hmm.
The ship was destroyed. So I joined the Army National Guard. And I guess about not quite a year after I was in it, they relaxed the regulations saying you couldn't have two brothers in it. Like I said, I just wanted to fly.
Yeah.
So I went through the 4 years at Louisiana State University and went to Webb Air Force Base in Big Spring, Texas, right down from your school.
Right.
And I was in the first class to go to the T-38.
So you're flying the T-38 then as a trainer?
Yes, T-37 and T-38.
Well, tell me about that level of flight training. How prepared were you? What were the courses like? How did you take to flying?
Well, the courses, they weren't bad, but if you had an engineering degree, you had a one step up on the rest of the guys.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, flying, you either could do it or you couldn't. We started, if I remember correctly, something like 65 in the class, and we finished 20, 23, or 24.
So everyone else washed out?
They washed out, and one reason was that we were in the first class, like I stated, for the T-38. They had a experiment, what they call an experimental class. They had about 22 students at the Randolph. They did that for logistics to see what would break on the airplane so they could replace it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what they figured and what happened, the engine started going on. And we had something like 28 aircraft, the best of my memory, 28 aircraft. And we only had something like 17 that had engines in them.
Mm.
So what they did, you drew a straw. The one who got the shortest straw soloed first. So this, what happened, you know, you would fly on a Monday, and you may not fly till a week later. And every time you went up, it was like going up the first time.
Hmm.
So when they started going, you had to solo, if I remember right, you had to solo when you had 12 or 13 hours. That's what they put, the restrictions they were putting on you. And a lot of the guys couldn't do it, you know. Every time they went up, it was like the first time they were going up.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I could say I was very fortunate because I made the cut.
Yeah. It just seemed to stick with you a little bit better than some of the other guys, it sounds like. Yeah.
And my goal was eventually to go with the airline. So we didn't have to, we got out of being first class in the T-38, which we go 1.5 times the speed of sound. We only got 2 F-4s. And we were supposed to get all F-4s, but we got 2 of them. So I got 133. Which was it was a big airplane. It had a wingspan of 179 feet 8 inches.
Mm-hmm.
So and most runways are only 150 feet wide. So I got that warning to go with the airline. When I was in for about a year, I started calling around with the airline. And the problem I ran into is when I came on active duty, I was 24 years old. The cutoff of power training was 25.
Mm.
And the airlines wanted you to have something like 2,500 hours flying time. Well, when I got to 2,500 hours, I was almost 28 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the cutoff of the airline. So that eliminated that right there.
Yeah.
So I just sat back and started enjoying flying the 133. The 133 was very interesting. It they built something like 60 of them, and we only had something like 22 when they put them in the boneyard. So McDonnell Douglas made it. I don't know what happened to them. They were, most of them disappeared over the Atlantic and the Pacific.
Hmm.
Disappeared. So, but it was interesting flying. We in the 124, if you're familiar with it, were the only ones that could carry outsized cargo. So we went to, I was in the organization, the squadron, 39th MAS, not quite a year. I had a trip complete around the world. Like I said, it was interesting. We went to some nice places. We were treated very well when we got there. And some of them were very, very interesting.
Please, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, that's the 133. I stayed in it to, I went to, well, let me back up. We started supplying Vietnam, and we would go approximately, you could plan on at least one trip to Vietnam from Dover, Delaware, Air Force Base. From Dover, one trip a month.
Mm-hmm.
And we would come back with about a total of 92, 93 hours of flying time.
And when did you start making these trips over to Vietnam? What year?
In '63.
Okay, did you know what was going on in Vietnam over at that time?
No, not really.
Mm-hmm.
We knew that something was building up. It was the first time, it was my first trip over there, it was the first time we had the possibility of being shot down. And we bought most of the equipment for building runways, PSP buildings, control tower. And it was a steady flow of equipment and materials that were needed.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I hate to use this term, but you know, most of us were just fat, dumb, and happy.
Yeah.
We were getting some good flying time. We were going to places that there was a possibility of incoming fire when we were landing. When we went there at night, because we would go from Wake Island to Tassanut mostly. And after we offloaded and unloaded, see, we would offload 7 UEs and unload 7 broken ones, and if they could get 1 or 2 out of the 7, we were money ahead.
Mm-hmm. So this kind of should give you an idea of how big the plane is if you can fit 7 Hueys on there.
Oh yeah.
Just a huge ship.
Us and the one C-124 were the only 2 airplanes that could carry the prop for the 133.
Mm-hmm.
The prop was 18 feet in diameter. And in that 18-foot diameter, the tips, if they were half an inch longer, the tips would have been going through the speed of sound.
Hmm.
And let's see, height was 48 feet 8 inches, length was 157 feet 6 inches, maximum speed was 354, which we never did see, cruising speed was 310, range was 4,000 miles, service ceiling was 23,300. Well, they built the airplane to carry the Atlas missile. The Atlas missile would slide right into the back end of the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And what they started doing, they were supposed to fly from Dover to Delaware to Rhine Mount, Germany, nonstop to 33,000 feet. Well, it never did do it. We were lucky we could get up to 13,000 feet because they started flying the airplane like they were flying the C-130, short hops.
Mm-hmm.
And being that large in size, we started getting splits in the metal, fractures in the metal, and it just wasn't made to hop up, come down, hop up, short flight.
Right.
I mean, when we went from Dover to Rhine Mine, we were lucky we could get up to 12,000.
Hmm.
And we did what we called step climb. You would climb out, and with your fuel load on, you could limit it, say, to 13,000 feet, you'd go up to 13,000 feet. And after you cruised up there for maybe an hour and a half to 2 hours, because we carried 118,000 pounds of fuel. So after you did it for maybe 1 hour, 2 hours, you burned off the fuel, which meant you were getting lighter.
Mm-hmm.
Then you could step climb up another 2,000, maybe 2,000 feet. But you had your hands full. They, one thing that they did when they built the airplane, they never completely finished the test top on it. And if you would take it up and stall it, you want to fly up over on his back.
Hmm.
So, anyway, so much for that.
Yeah.
They never found out what caused him to disappear. At the end, when they finally grounded him, they were getting splits in the fuselage. So they put stainless steel belly bands that were about 4 inches wide, completely around the aircraft. I guess that was a crowning blow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they grounded him for maybe 4 or 5 months. And all we did was sit in the room mostly and try to picture what was happening, how it was happening, why it was happening. And never came up with an answer.
Mm-hmm.
It's just one of those things. When you're talking with all of my crew, 8 people on board. Okay, what else
yeah.
do you need now?
Well, let's take you back to your time hauling these supplies and things over to Vietnam. Obviously, this is in preparation for a much larger buildup. You know, you're hauling, like you say, the PSP. You're doing all the sort of stuff to build up the air presence there.
Yeah, well,
in
what we were doing in 63, Cameron Bay wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
So when we did, we brought over, we started with, you familiar with PSP?
Yes.
Okay, we bought the PSP over there mainly for the taxiways, and they were using the taxiways as the runways. So, and that's when we started down at Thompson Earth, and went to Cameron Bay, and we started running. We had one, I forget the name of it, it was right on the coast, a Marine base. Airfield. But we got them all completed, and then in 68, that's when I got my orders for the ranch.
Mm-hmm. When you're making these trips, like you say, almost monthly trips from the U.S. to Vietnam, does this give you any sort of idea of what might be coming over in that part of the world? I mean, if there's this much of a material buildup that perhaps troops are going to follow sometime soon?
That's a yes or no question. You know, you could figure that, well, we're bringing a lot over, so that means what we used to say is we're going to bring everything over we need to build an airstrip. And once we get the airstrip built, then the Vietnamese are going to take it over.
Mm-hmm.
We'll build it till they were ready for it.
I see. Now, did you have any idea about the political situation of what was going on over there?
Not really. Just what we read in the newspaper
yeah.
or the Time magazine.
Mm-hmm. All right. So,
but
no, please.
Just like for the Agent Orange, we were, maybe it was my fault, but we had a vague idea of what was going on because they were told us that the same thing the farmers use to kill weeds.
Mm-hmm.
And having flown over there in the 133, I had no idea that come 68 I would be going on over there.
Mm-hmm.
Because we needed. There was only 2 squadrons that had the 133s. Us at Dover Air Force Base and then the one over at Travis in California. And if they took pilots from our squadron and sent them over to Vietnam, they had to take pilots from either pilot training, which they didn't have the experience in the aircraft,
mm-hmm.
you know, to keep it going. But, no one with the Agent Orange, we really only found out when we went to the Herbert Field for the training.
Yeah.
And then, I guess if you sit back and think about it, they didn't talk too much about it because maybe they didn't want us to know about it.
Hmm.
But that's only a guessing on my part.
Sure, sure.
I was only a captain, you know. What do captains know?
Yeah, sometimes only what they're told, I guess. All right, so you're making these trips to Vietnam. How long does this last? When do you stop making these trips over?
Well, the 133s were going over there while I was stationed over there.
Mm-hmm.
69.
Okay. But what about you personally? How long were you doing this?
We had 1 year assignments, and if you got there at the end of the month, some of your duty over there was being cut to the first of the month, and you could get almost a month off.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was over there, they went ahead and canceled that.
Yeah.
And the other thing we did was we carried the aluminum caskets back. We had the whole airplane filled up with bodies. We would make notes back to Travis. Travis always knows where it is, the East Coast mortuary.
And were you doing this back in 63?
No.
This has been later. During your tour, yeah.
67.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense for the timeline. So you're flying the supplies back and forth. What do you do from, say, 1964 before you're sent over to Vietnam?
Well, Travis Air Force Base took care of the Pacific, and we took care of being at Dover, the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, for good behavior, they would give us a specific trip. But we still had a lot going on over in Europe and other countries.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
We had trips to India, bringing three fire engines. An airstrip that was actually a World War II airstrip near Agra, India, where the Taj Mahal is.
Right.
And outside Chicago, there was enough to keep us busy. And we had a lot of classified trips that we had a box. I'll call it a box. Filled up almost the whole cargo compartment. You didn't know what was in there. I had one. I took over to Thompson Hood, and it had a full colonel at the time that was the escort for it.
Pretty important stuff then.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was classified. No markings on the box. The reason why I remember that is because we had weather and we had other problems, but we got the cargo there on time. And he came up with a copy of my orders, the colonel did. And he said, I'm going to have a letter of recommendation going back to your squad command, and blah, 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 blah. Never happened.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So are you flying the 133 exclusively during this time?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of those things once you got it stamped on your back, you never got rid of it.
Yeah, you were just going to keep flying it.
That's right.
Yeah. And when did you say they started to ground the planes because of the mechanical difficulties?
Let's see, April of 70, around the end of the 60s, early 70s.
Okay. All right.
Let's see, I got a I got some different information. It was only 35 built. That's when the C-5 came aboard.
Tell me about how you wound up going to Vietnam to serve with the Ranch Hand mission. When did you get your orders for Vietnam?
Let's see. I would say, this is a guesstimate, about May of 68. Because I went through training in July of 60. Yeah, it was the summer of
68. Okay. Is this a change that you wanted? Did you volunteer to go to Vietnam?
Nope.
I just said that's where you're headed.
Well, you could see the squadron, how frequently it was being tapped to send people over there.
Yeah, just pulling more and more folks out.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're also going to get you trained up in the 123.
So I went down to Herbert Field.
Yeah, tell me about this training. How did you like the 123?
Loved it. It was, and I guess I shouldn't say that because you only love females. But it was good training. The only thing, to be honest with you, that flying this 133 with a wingspan of 180 feet. Picture this, flying treetop level around Herbert Field, Florida. Flying maybe 25, 30, 40 feet. And then taking the airplane and rolling it in a 90-degree bank. You know, that, but the 133 was an aircraft that once you went past 20 degrees or 10 degrees in the roll, I mean in the turn, the airplane just wanted to keep on going.
Mm-hmm.
And being that close to the ground, you don't have, you know, I always wonder why we wore parachutes. But it was good training. I respected the airplane. It's one of these things, you walk up to the airplane, and the airplane looked at you and told you, if I knew as much about you as you know about me, would you let me fly you? And you could get down there and roll it in a 90-degree bank and just do a complete 360.
Mm.
It was good training. People who taught the instructors had good time in the aircraft. They were very confident. And we went through the training, and they sent us over in groups of seven. And funniest thing, when I got over there, we went through Clark Air Base in the Philippines, the jungle survival training. And when we got into Thompson Hood, we got off the aircraft, civilian. Which ones were, do you remember the ones that, what airlines had the aircraft that were, commercial aircraft that were purple, pink?
Oh boy, I wouldn't know. I know that a number of airlines participated in this.
Could you name a few?
TWA, but they weren't, or Pan Am, I'm sorry.
No.
But they weren't, what are some others? Flying Tigers, I think, for some years early on.
Well, anyway, we got there, and the thing was, once you landed, you picked up the phone and called over to Benoit, which was only 23 miles away. I'm here. Get me over to your field. And whoever it was answered the phone, I told him who I was. I'm over here reporting for duty, and he came back, and he says, what the beep do you want me to do about it? He says, get yourself to over here the best way you can.
Hmm.
So this, after sleeping in Tasmania's airport all night long, the next morning is when I called him, and took us into 8 o'clock the following night to go 23 miles. Got on at 1:30. The 1:30 went all over Vietnam and ended up, the last stop was at Tasmania's Benoit.
That's a long way around the barn to get to Benoit.
Yes, but the way I figured about it, the duty started the day you left the state.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we got there and cleared in and did whatever we had to do, and then they sent us up to Fang Rang for, I guess you could call it, confidence building. We had the 123s and we carried cargo. Just to give us an idea of what it was like to land at the different type of airfields they had, the dirt roads they had, and carry cargo. And we did this for maybe a little over a month. And then we went back to Benoit, and then we went up to the Nain to get checked out, high call and two call, which was mountain terrain.
Mm-hmm.
Got that checked out. I don't know how long it was, maybe a month. We came back down to Benoit and got 4 call and 5 call. Let's see, high call, 2 call, no, it was 3 call and 4 call,
mm-hmm.
which was a flat land. And then once we get that finished, then we flew 3 missions and got the purpose call off. Clock in the morning, 2 missions every day. And I also, since I, like I said, I was the captain, flying the 133, I had a lot of flying time.
Mm-hmm.
So I did most of their test hops for them.
Yeah.
Take off, times in their fly east to the coast, but then to the PT, Papa Tango. There, you would shut one engine down and do all you had to do, check it out, install it up, cruise, and let it warm up, and turn around and go back to the top of the road. And whenever they needed it, I did the check twice. And it just, I flew mostly, I guess you could say about once a day.
Mm-hmm.
And we either had Sunday off, and I found, for me, I enjoyed more if you can enjoy flying right over the trees and getting shot at. Flying possibly 6 days a week. It just made the time go by so much faster. And then we, towards my end of my duty there, we started getting missions up in North Vietnam. We knew where the Ho Chi Minh Trail came out because there were more than one Ho Chi Minh Trail. And we wanted to see where it came from into the DMZ.
Mm-hmm.
And I had 3 missions up there, which 4 too many. It was just like the 4th of July on those things. Because
yeah.
They had, at the time, I don't guess it was class 5 anymore, they had that forward spring. You know, we're flying 125 and they're flying 230. Can't spray because we had limit on. Do you, or are you aware of the spray limit?
Yeah, I would like for you to talk about them, if you don't mind.
Well, we just said, you couldn't have a temperature over 85 degrees, which
mm-hmm.
was a big joke. You couldn't have more than a 10-knot crosswind. And you couldn't spray in the monsoon season either.
Mm-hmm.
So you had wind speed. There were areas that weren't supposed to be sprayed.
Right.
The crosswind would mess it up for you.
Right.
up at 2 o'clock in the morning, on target at sunrise, we'd do one mission, come back to the Fang Ring to re-herbicide, fill up again, or then water, and go do another one. So we were finished normally around 11:30 in the morning.
Mm-hmm. And that's flying two missions a day.
That was about the most. If we had a augment up at the name, because the name could take care of ICO and TUCO,
right?
We'd go TGY up there.
And did you do that very often?
And what you're asking now, what do you classify as very often?
Well, let me ask you this: how often would you be flying out of the name?
Maybe once or twice a month.
Mm.
So we had enough, you know, I maybe would go and then somebody else would go and it would be another 2 months before I go again.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember how frequent you had to do it to keep efficient. Because we flew flatland at 120 and 125 or 130 mount targets. The reason for that was these airplanes were started off originally, the 123 as a glider. And they had a lot of time on them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had a three ship, that was another thing, two limitations. You can only fly in mountain targets, you can only fly a three ship. We had 13 ships in flatland. But you carry. You had three ships, and if you were going down on the other side of the mountain, because some of them, we started off at 9,000, 10,000 feet and ended up at sea level, right on the beach.
Mm.
And what you would do, you know, if you would have a three ship, some ships were more airstream than others. Some reason. You know, the cow flaps didn't close all the way, or something to cause drag to slow you down. So that's why they limited it only to three, because you would be going down on the other side of the mountain. Lead would be flying, and all of a sudden, two would go past lead. Two had everything back and forth as you go to slow it down, but it just kept on picking up speed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one reason why we did the three ships. Another thing we did occasionally is we did the flying to DMZ to all the airstrips to pick up the KIA, the Army.
Mm-hmm.
We'd go TDY up to the range for maybe a week. And we'd just fly, get up in the morning, fly, just keep on going around Robin. Picking up the body bags and bringing them back to the main and offloading them and going back and filling them up again.
That had to have been difficult duty, I would think.
Yes. What they gave you a surgical mask and a jaw of Vic salve. Put on your, you know, Vic salve around your nose for the holder. And we had, I remember my first time up there, we had two Marines bring a body bag, which is, of course, you know, threw it out on the aircraft. And it was about the size of, you know what a B-4 bag looks like?
Mm-hmm, but can you explain what that would be like for someone who's not familiar with it?
Well, like I had mentioned earlier, flying over there in the early 60s, we would load up the airplane. That's the only way they got the bodies back, is bringing them back in the aluminum caskets.
Mm-hmm.
So we had been bringing them back since the mid-60s. So it was something that had to be done. You know,
right.
You had to just bend over, open up your brain and dump it, and do what you had to do. We had one that was between the P-4 bag and the parachute bag.
Hmm.
And they had two Marines in there. They were in a foxhole and a tiger got in there. Took care of them.
Yeah.
But, if you, I found if you didn't turn around in the seat to look to see what was going on in the rear end of the aircraft, it was much easier doing it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start looking back there, and you start conjuring, I guess that is, that's the correct word, stories and what happened to them. And you had to concentrate, because you had to still concentrate on the flying.
Sure. Nonetheless, that would have been incredibly difficult, difficult duty.
Mm. Well, we didn't do it for, I guess I did it maybe three times during my whole year there.
Yeah.
Because we only filled in and augmented the name when they had other important missions.
Mm-hmm.
Not that these weren't important, but they mostly just had the spray missions and didn't have enough aircraft.
Yeah.
But, and during the monsoon season, we flew cargo, because you can't, couldn't spray. But, it was interesting flying the mountains and flying the flatland down in the Delta where the Australians were. And, we had, made a lot of friends. Tell you one thing, we had some at the officers club there at Benoit. We had F4 pilots that used to come in, and you know, we started, they were bragging on how good they were flying 100 and blah blah blah. We said, okay, you want to fly with us? Sure. Are you gonna fly C7s or 130s? No, we're flying Agent Orange. Agent who? Agent Orange. Nope, we're not going to fly with you. You fly too close to the ground.
Well, let me ask you about that, Colonel. What did you think about this mission? I mean, it could be incredibly difficult. I mean, you're not in a fighter jet, but you're awfully close to the ground, and you're not flying very fast.
Yeah, and we have no weapons.
Mm-hmm. So what did you think about this mission?
Well, like I said, Fat, Dumb, and Happy. It's a, must have been an important mission if they had two squadrons of 123s over there doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Most of our requests came from the Army to avoid ambush. We did it for the Navy coming up the Saigon River so they wouldn't be ambushed.
Mm-hmm.
Army came to us, Special Forces people, when they needed it. The Special Forces camp and the vegetation started growing up too high. We were going in. You know, it would last 7-8 months, depending on how much rain you got. We got a lot of rain, green would grow back. But, like I was going to say, it must have been important that they had two squadrons doing it over there.
Yeah.
If, you know, if you're a farmer and you're spraying for weeds, you don't spray at 50 feet above the ground. You get as close to the weeds as you can get.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the reason why they were flying treetop level.
Right.
To me, some of the areas we went to took heavy ground fire. I think what saved us from taking a lot of hits was that the trees were higher than they were. You know, they were on the ground. The trees, the top of the trees were, say, another 30 feet up. And you could hear the airplane coming, but you couldn't see it until it went overhead. But we took 50 cal hits, especially up in North Vietnam. Very easily knock an engine out.
Did you receive any serious damage to your planes?
Well, the most serious damage I remember was having the engine knocked out with the cow. Having the aileron cable knocked out so you couldn't make a turn. You had to try to keep it straight and level. It was not able to go in a roll.
Mm-hmm.
And I was right behind one of them that happened to him. We had a seat. Sky crane come and pick it up and take it back to Tom.
Okay.
Fix it up. It did a crash landing, but it didn't. Like I said, the airplane was designed originally as a glider. And it could take a good licking, really. And, like I said, the mountain targets were interesting because not much room for error.
How would your flying change from, say, down in the Delta to up in I Corps?
Well, we added, depends on the terrain, we would add 5 to 10 knots higher airspeed.
Mm-hmm.
And the pilots were good. I hate to brag, but we were good. Some of the stuff we would do, and I'd come back and I would say, don't tell me I did that. You know, it was, depends on how much ground fire you were taking, how good the F-4 could be to protect you, or the Cobra helicopters to protect you. Because in a Delta, we had a squadron of Cobras that was flying air support for us. We'd come in so close to the water because you could see off the props the water spread.
Hmm.
You know what I'm talking about?
They're coming in low.
Low, really low. And then we popped up right over the ground when we hit the ground. And the helicopters, the Cobras, were supposed to be off to our right and left, and they were right in front of us.
Hmm.
But chalk that up as experience.
Right.
And you don't have to make sure when you breathe the Cobra pilots the next day if they find support for you. You got to remember and you got to emphasize that there are certain limits we can do down at that low altitude. I mean, on the test tops when I used to fly, I used to have a parachute. Well, being that close to the ground, you don't even have time to get out and put the parachute in the airplane itself to put the parachute back on. You're that close to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But, like my mother used to say, it all comes out in the wash.
Right.
And I can honestly say that when we came back to the States, I went back to the 133s, that we were the best we could be.
Mm-hmm.
We really were. And we only had one lieutenant that was killed over an outfit. What happened was down in the Delta, and he was showing off, trying to climb out real steep. The aircraft stalled out. So, like I said before, you got to respect the airplane. The airplane has to, if it can happen, the airplane has to respect you. You're working together. You're working as a team. And everybody was, like I said, proficient in what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing we didn't do is fly like SAC dedicated crews to each airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Because you come not as proficient as you do by yourself. Because you fly with a guy all the time, and he does this all the time. And there's one time he forgets to do it, but you figure he's doing it because he's always done it.
Right.
So if you have a different pilot every time, you don't become like, you know he's going to do it when you've never flown with you before.
Yeah, so you're a little more careful. The checks are a little more closely guarded, that's probably. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, when he calls, you know, switch on, you look over there and make sure that switch is on. Just like we had. I did a, I did a photo album with Butch's over at Wright-Patterson Museum. And when you landed in the 123 on the ground, you took your throttles and you came back to idle. And then you had two green lights, one for each engine that would come on. And when those green lights came on, that meant that airplane was ready to go into reverse. Well, we had one that the left one didn't go into reverse, but the right one did, which caused the airplane to do a turn to the right real steep. And it was on the ground, and it went off the runway and rode over two helicopters. But see, things like that, supposedly the kid's co-pilot called two green lights.
Mm-hmm.
And he either had one because he was busy doing something else, and he's always had, let's see, got a beep here. Hold on a second, I'll be right with you.
Sure.
So like I said, he either looked at him too fast, didn't pay attention. There's a lot of things that could happen. He could have been distracted by something because they were landing on PSP.
Mm-hmm.
And that's rough land. That's a rough runway. And it's rough enough to take the fillings off your teeth. So, but, you know, something like that could happen. Like I used to say on crew briefings, we're all human and we all make mistakes. I'm not asking you not to make the mistakes, but just keep them to a minimum.
Mm-hmm.
And, but flying that much, like I said, the 50 cals, they look like illuminated beer cans, traces. I used to say it looks like illuminated beer can coming up at you.
Probably pretty big and intimidating, I would think.
Yep. Especially when it was nice about that, getting back with the 123 again. It was designed as a glider, so it had no engine. The testing they went through to be a glider is what the best thing they could do. Was the old Tom X thing that keeps on ticking?
Right.
Okay, what else?
Can you tell me about what sort of things you would do when you weren't on duty? What was your typical routine?
Racquetball.
Racquetball.
Jogging. Because one thing they didn't want to see, the flying crews, Captain had a reward to North Vietnamese, something like $150. And as you went up in rank, money got higher. And we did a lot of jogging. The other thing the North Vietnamese would do is if they captured you, the first thing they did was take your shoes away from you.
Mm-hmm.
So you did stuff like that to toughen your feet. What could you do at 25 feet? feet above the ground. You know, you really didn't have, they shot out your engines, you didn't have time to prepare for the landing.
Sure. Were you involved in any other sort of activities when you were off duty? Did you have any jobs other than flying?
No, not really. We worked with the Benoit, the city. We worked and helped build a new school for them. Projects like that.
Yeah. Well, tell me about that.
Well, we get our toolkits and go out, and if they needed, let's say, water, we would dig a hole across the highway or the street, whatever you want to call it, put a pipe down, and then cover it up with rock. The painting, fixing broken windows, just a patch up.
Yeah. Was this something that you guys decided to do together on your own, or was it something that higher-ups told you to do?
It wasn't, you know, you can tell somebody to do it, or you can strongly recommend it. That's what it was. But we didn't mind because it gave us something else to do. You know, all we had was jogging. Had a ball. I think they had one. They had a tennis court, I'm not sure. Basketball goal. And that was it. And the heat and humidity, you can only take so much of it. So if it was something working indoors where it was a little cooler, I had a draft or something like that. That's what we did.
Did you stay in contact with the folks back at home?
Yes. Send a tape or send a letter or something like that. The mail wasn't overnight delivery.
Right.
We didn't have direct radios or telephones like we had today. But maybe that was better because you were getting too close.
Focus more on the job at hand this way.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
And I know I did. I would go to the admin office and see if there was anything I could do. And we get on a mission to carry us. First thing you do when you crash land is get rid of the M16. Take it by the barrel and swing it against the tree and break it.
Why is that?
Because number one, you couldn't hide and shoot it because it made too much noise. But here I am. And we didn't, I think we carried two clips. That was just enough to get you in trouble.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at that, yeah.
Yeah, well, we had a saw, I didn't know. I think he had two tours or three tours over there. He had some intelligent stuff that came out of his mouth. Not knowing. You go to Jungle Survival, and what are you going to do? If it depends on, chances of surviving the mountain fog is almost impossible.
Yeah.
Flat land straight ahead, and the glider, you could put it in a nice little piece. And we had the, do you know how the F-4 did air support?
Yeah, I do, but could you explain to someone who might not know?
Well, you came in. Either three ships, let's say three ships, either right echelon, which means lead was forward, and two and three were off to his right. supposedly where the smoke was, they were shooting, they were hitting where the smoke was, and they were doing some damage. What I mean is eliminating. The ones I liked the best was the P-57 Canberras, the RC pad.
Hmm.
The wings were thick enough that you could put a 50 caliber machine gun into the wing and put it on a maximum of 45 degrees slant down to the front of the aircraft. So in other words, you could just fly straight and level and shoot up the ground in front of you rather than have to be pointed down.
Mm-hmm.
Follow me?
Yes. What were the facilities like there at Benoit?
What facilities?
Your living quarters, the mess, all of it.
Bronson Hudson, we had we had the 133s when they were coming in. I knew they were coming in. I called a squad in there and air conditioning.
Hmm.
We had the fellow was Bronson Hudson with air conditioning, trying to keep from the dust storms keeping the dust out. They'd have to strip the air conditioner about once a month and hold it down. It was unbelievable.
Pretty tough conditions then.
Yes, it was. But you see, but God gave us that to get our mind off of other things.
There you go. Well, what about R&R? Did you get a chance to go on R&R?
Yeah, they wanted us to go six. You could put in for about every 6 months, halfway through the tour if you want.
Mm-hmm.
You were limited to where you could go. Some of them went to Australia if there was a flight. Brand up was the airline.
Okay.
I didn't mean interrupted. Familiar with Brand up?
Sure.
Yeah, that's the airline. And so you could either go to Hawaii or Australia.
And where did you go? Were you married at this time?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it ended when I got back.
Mm-hmm.
I had a guy that I knew who was right next door to the door. And the things he was telling my wife I was doing. And like living in the Hilton Hotel, you know. But anyway, that was the best, because I met my casualty station. Same time I was over there. We met Owen Wiesbaden, Germany. So Owen Wiesbaden, I was flying to Vietnam.
Yeah, you were both in Vietnam at the same time, but didn't meet until you got to Germany. Your wife was telling me that a few days ago, yeah.
I don't know how people had time to do anything. You really did the jogging and exercise to tire you out so that when, after you took a shower and hit the bed, you were out.
Yeah. You had been there for a while, or say, let's look at, say, toward the end of your tour. What did you think about the way the war was being fought? I mean, you had your small part of the war. Were you aware of what else was going on?
Just about full of weight.
Yeah, it's probably above your pay grade at the time.
Yeah, it was, you know.
Well, let's go ahead and bring you home from this tour. What did you think about your time there in Vietnam as you were wrapping up, as you were a short timer getting ready to come home? What did you think about your mission there, about the work you were doing?
Well, for as much shooting they did add up, especially once flying a whole across the DMZ. I felt that we must have been doing something right because we were sure taking a hell of a lot of hits.
Mm-hmm. You're definitely getting their attention.
Yeah. And, to fly a flat piece of land the size of a football field and have 20 Northeast and East standing there with rifles and pistols, and you're flying right straight towards them. Right on each side of it comes to the F-4s or the helicopters and shoots them. That was a sight to be seen.
I'm sure it was.
Then that night when we got the 122-millimeter rockets that were coming, I always thought of that poor North Vietnamese guy that is only 5'2" tall, carrying a 6-foot, 7-foot rocket. North Vietnam, all the way down to Saigon, setting it up to fire and have it be a gun. That's not the way to do it.
Yeah.
But they were dedicated because they, you know, if you were to capture one, he didn't have a card that said you come home in 1 year.
Uh-huh.
They were there for the length of it. And sometimes, you know, like we did World War II. They didn't come home in a year. They stayed over there until they either come home with a box or injured so much they couldn't work, fight.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I read the paper, critique or criticism on Agent Orange, tells me you did a good job.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going to happen. I hear rumors that eventually to find out the impact of the Agent Orange. They are going to go over there. Their physical is to the north facing between the Vietnamese and north and south. Is very political.
Mm-hmm.
Some say this happened, some say that happened. If they can't find anything that's going to the disease you have on some particular Agent Orange.
Well, let's talk about that for a little bit. And it kind of jumped us ahead a little bit, but since you brought it up, obviously a very political issue. The Air Force did a very long, very intense study on the ranch hand and a control group. Were you part of this study?
Yes, I was.
Can you talk to me about that study, how it was, what its goals were? Can you tell me about the processes of the physicals of the study itself?
Well, the first one was in Houston. And we carried gallon jug around with it so they peed in so they could catch the urine. The doctors were with us all the time for physical. We were not allowed to talk to the doctors about anything they were doing. Supposedly they didn't know we were Agent Orange. So we had the orders not to talk to them, not to give them any information. If they asked about it, we were supposed to tell the colonel who was in charge of it. So we just, you know, we kept quiet. It was a 3-day, very thorough physical, both psychologically and physical. It was a 10-year study. I didn't push it. I felt I was getting a good physical. I didn't think I had anything wrong with me, which I apparently didn't, because they didn't find anything. I had a friend of mine who flew from Milwaukee, Philippines, down to Green Benoit. Spent 10 minutes on the ground and left. They came down with colon cancer. Is it something that was, could have been in his genes that he was going to get it one way or the other?
Mm-hmm.
And he was punching his genes. It's just, you know, maybe it was people I had the need, not the need, but talking to was the Army. And everything Army comes up with. VA can't prove it's not.
Mm-hmm.
The farmers get all this. I'm sure they get a little backwash from the wind when they were spraying their crop. I really don't know.
Yeah.
And I guess it's laziness on my part. And the reason why I say I feel lazy is that if you're going and you're having nothing come up, because you couldn't pump the doctors because they weren't supposed to ask.
Right.
Theoretically, they had no knowledge whatsoever why we were there. They thought we were doing federal physical. And I went to the reunion two ago. We had it at Wright-Patterson. Have a big dinner underneath But my friends that were over there, seven of us that went over there, they're okay. I say they're okay to back up. Unless they have something that they're semi-embarrassed about, I don't know what it could be. It could be colon cancer. But, you know, it's been quiet.
Mm-hmm. And have you had any sort of issues? Sometimes that helps, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, let's take you home from the war. Tell me about your career and your life following the war. Because you, of course, retire in the Air Force after over 26 years.
Yeah, I put with my Air National Guard time in Air Force. I ended up with active duty of 33 and a half years.
Mm-hmm.
I came back to the 133, same squadron. Because, like I said, once you got that stamp on your back,
yeah.
Because it was a big airplane. It's a fine small one, so in college. It was an airplane you had to respect, because if you didn't, it would come back and bite you in the ass. But I still enjoy the challenge of flying. And it's one of those, they only built 30, total 35 of those.
But those of you who did fly it flew it an awful lot.
Oh yeah, that's the only thing we did. We we had a limitation on how much flying time we could get in a month. I think it was something like 40 or 50 hours. But anyway, once you hit this magical number, and you didn't fly anymore until the next month, you know. Which was fine, you know. Flying for the length of time it took us to go from Dover to Corpus Christi, Texas, to Travis, to Hickam, to Wake, to Guam, the Philippines, Okinawa, direct to Midway, Midway to Travis, Travis to Raikai, Raikai back to go for the trip. So,
did you stay? I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
And what I did is I was working in a command post. So I would work at the command post. 2 weeks, get a 2 week flying break, go back to the command post for 2 weeks, get a 2 week flying break. That's the way the time went when I went back.
Okay.
Which was good.
Now, you're back in the States when, in 73, when American troops pull out of Vietnam, and 75, when the communists take over in April of 75. What were your thoughts on the way the war ended?
Kind of disappointed. I felt, you know, you go to win, you don't go to lose. There are companies that make refrigerators, but when the war comes, they make bombs or something else. And like I said, you go to win, you don't go for an endurance. People who know about this with World War II, but most of those were passed away by then. We weren't respected. But then you say, why should they respect me when I'm over there supposedly doing what's being published in the newspaper? that gets caught in the rain, once it gets too much water on it, he shakes it off and starts over again.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the kind of the treatment or the perception of Vietnam veterans when they got home. You stayed in the Air Force for a number of years afterward. Did you face any sort of a difficulty adjusting coming back to the U.S.?
No. Like I said early in the beginning, to me, this was just a long stayover from when I used to fly over there once a week, once a month.
Yeah.
It didn't bother me at all. I didn't have any heartburn over it. Where the other pilots that were there, it was the first time they were separated from their families. Joy was hard.
Mm-hmm.
It was the same thing on a fireman. He joins to be a fireman. He's going to have to go to a fire someday.
Right.
If you want to be a military man, you've got the chances of going to a war someday. Even though some of the times the war is not declared.
Mm-hmm.
But, I don't know. I sit here right now thinking maybe it was better to stay in the military than get out.
What do you say that?
Because I was still doing the things I was doing before I went over there.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have to start over a new life.
Yeah. And doing things you enjoyed too, it sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, heck. We would take an airplane, say 33 days and fly around the world. You know, who could go into Agra, India, the Taj Mahal? Who could go to Africa? I mean, I've been all over. Being retired now, I retired in 88. After being retired, people say, well, how come you don't travel? Well, first of all, I put 3.5 years in the military. I had the luxury of having my wife fly with me occasionally, but she was also military.
Mm-hmm.
That was
that's okay. Well, just one last question that I have for you, Colonel. As you look back on Vietnam, everything that Vietnam has meant, as someone who was there, as someone who helped fight the war, what do you think is the lasting historical legacy of the Vietnam War? I'm sorry?
That we tried to keep North Vietnam from taking over South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Russia's doing the same thing now. They need a warm water port. That's why they're doing what they do over there. But, I guess there was more to it than the reading the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
Put it together to see if it makes sense to you. Most of the times it doesn't. As an example, the barber, Thompson Nook, barber at Pinoir, he used to get his haircut, shave it, and straight razor. His father dead one morning in the barber shop. $5 he was. So you had things like that, you know, when you say accidentally, but it was just because they were jerky around it. But the other thing I noticed that the South Vietnamese themselves was the affected by death. Because I remember one day there was a flatbed truck going along outside of the base on the road. There was a bunch of them that was out there beneath, I guess there was something, walking around on a flatbed. One of them fell off. Truck rode over and killed him. Truck stopped. They got a group of them got off. Something I feel you couldn't end. You wouldn't end. Because, you know, a group of North Vietnamese was killed, and next day you had another group.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that helped.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Is that dedication and you know, the reasons why the different sides were doing what they were doing, I think that is makes the Vietnam War so complex.
This is the dedication. This is our goal to have it finished.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we're doing. This is what we're going to keep on doing to do it. But I think I was fortunate because I had been flying over there since the mid-60s. So when I got my orders in 68, I wasn't surprised because a friend of mine who was the admin officer, about 2 months before I got my orders, he got word that I was going. He made up some fake orders and gave to me. He said, "Dick, he said, I'm sorry to do this for you, they got your name." We laughed about it, you know, and so when the real ones came down, you know, it wasn't no big surprise, because we knew it was coming, because they were taking one and two and one and two.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way that happened. I was used to flying over there, spending time over there, and I knew what the countryside was like, and I knew how much we had to rebuild or build. I could say most of the things that happened were not a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
I expected it. And got it.
Well, Colonel, is there anything else you'd like to add to the interview before we bring it to a close?
That's the first time you called, I've been sitting down and trying to think.
Well, it's certainly up for the folks who want to use the materials and listen to the interviews to decide. But it's invaluable information. It really is.
Yep.
All right.